This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The Timberwolves, the Clippers, and L.A. and Golden State have fallen short, and neither are the Portlands looking great. The Hornets pack no sting, the Jazz is flat, Atlanta's dead, the Knicks, the Bucks, the Bobcats, and the Raptors may be said to all be playing golf, just like the Cavaliers and Magic, an ending that Orlando may regard as somewhat tragic. But elsewhere, in the 16 places housing better teams, the NBA keeps bouncing as large men pursue their dreams. Joining me now on the line from New Orleans to comment on same is Benjamin Hockman, who follows the NBA for the Times-Picayune. Benjamin, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me. How you doing?
Very well, thank you. The Detroit Pistons and Philadelphia 76ers will, pardon the mixed metaphor, kick off the 2005 NBA playoffs this afternoon at the Palace of Auburn Hills. The Pistons are the defending champs. Does this afford them an early round edge?
They're going to be great. They're hot in April, and that's what you got to be heading into the playoffs. They're 11-1. Even though Allen Iverson is playing some of his best basketball of his career, he's the leading scorer in the NBA. The Pistons are going to breeze through the Philadelphia 76ers.
Later on today, the Dallas Mavericks and Houston Rockets will wage the Battle of Texas. Or is this an apt characterization?
Yeah, but Texas basketball, what can you say about it? I think both these teams, one of them's got to go to the second round by default, but I think that's about as far as we'll be seeing them go. I picked Dallas in this series, even though Houston's 36-16 since this new year began. I look at Dallas. They've got a good bench. They've got Jerry Stackhouse coming off. And their center, Dampier, is playing some great basketball, better than his whole career. And, of course, there's the Dirk factor.
Indiana managed to secure the sixth seed in the East, despite being without two of their best players for long stretches and, of course, without Ron Artest since November. Will a relatively rested Jermaine O'Neal and Steven Jackson carry the Pacers past the first round?
Yeah, I think the Pacers are going to win this series against Boston. Even though the Celtics are shooting lights out, they're shooting almost 47%, which is third best in the NBA. Two words, Reggie. I was joking down here. I mean, you could put Reggie Miller on the Hornets, and they'd win a playoff series this year. He's playing for the end of his career. He's going to be making jump shots, clutch jump shots, like we saw a decade ago.
The Phoenix Suns have never won an NBA championship, and their last finals appearance was back in 1993. They'll play Memphis beginning tomorrow. Is their potent offense enough to get them all the way to the finals this year?
I think so. They remind me of if it's fair to say, a poor man's Showtime.
Nice phrase.
Well, I appreciate it. No, I mean, in all seriousness, I mean, you look at this team, 1 through 5, you know, they've got sprinters. You know, they've got Nash running the show. He's averaging almost 12 assists a game, which is the highest it's been we've seen since the 94-95 season. I really like the makeup of this team. The one question the two questions people are throwing at him, age and defense. Well, they're young, but, I mean, Kobe Bryant was young when he won his first ring. Obviously, he had another teammate that was pretty good, too.
Yeah, had a big kid in the middle who wasn't too bad.
He was good. But, I mean, you look at Steve Nash, he's the MVP of this team and definitely the MVP of the Western Conference. So, sure, he's not a big guy, but he runs the show. And the thing about Phoenix on defense is that they're good at swarming, but can they keep that up for 48 minutes in the playoffs when suddenly everyone's just a little more intense? And I think we see Phoenix this year running the fast break, getting a lot of easy buckets against the teams they've been playing. But suddenly, in the playoffs, instead of guys loafing back, you see Carl Lewis is sprinting back and trying to draw charges. And it should be interesting to see what happens with the Suns, but I got them in the finals.
Seattle will play Sacramento in the opening round.
And I'm not going to watch.
So you're not going to watch. You've already decided that's one to pass on.
That's the one to pass on. That's the one to take your wife to dinner during.
Number one seed Miami may be without Shaquille O'Neal as the playoffs begin, but the Heat don't really need their all-star center to beat New Jersey, right?
New Jersey's hot, but you're right. I think Shaq will be playing in some of the games this series, but, I mean, Miami's just, they're just rolling. They're clicking well, and, I mean, that's key, obviously, this time. I know it's an obvious statement, but, I mean, you look at teams, some teams are great on paper, but when they're clicking in October and not in April, we got some problems. Dwayne Wade is obviously a rising superstar. They've got good bench depth, and even though the Nets are hot, they got Vince Carter, who's been playing really well the past week when he decided it's time to start playing, which is infuriating to watch a guy who can turn it on and off like that when he should have it on all the time. But I think Miami's got this series. I think the Nets might win a game or two, but come on.
It's too bad that Chicago plays Washington in the first round because both teams are playing well at this point, just in time for the postseason. I wonder, though, is this pairing evidence that the Eastern Conference is improving?
I think so. We see a lot of young players in the Eastern Conference on both these teams that are rising stars, the Ben Gordons and Kirk Heinrichs of the world. And then you look over at Washington, we've got Gilbert Arenas and Larry Hughes. I think these are two teams that are hungry, excited about being in the playoffs, obviously. And I'm going to go with Washington, though. The Bulls have Eddie Curry out. He's 16 points a game. He's out with an injury. And Luol Deng, the rookie sensation, has been out for a while. And Washington averages over 100 points a game. All they do is score.
This is the second straight year that the NBA has gone with a best-of-seven games format in the first round. So the first round is going to last 2 weeks if any series goes all seven games. Mm-hmm. Am I the only guy in the country who thought the playoffs were too long when they had a best-of-five series to start this thing?
Well, I'm with you, but, I mean, money talks, as they say. And if you can get a couple more games on TV, a couple more ads on TV, I think there's a man in New York that's smiling, and he's in charge. But yeah, it definitely drags on, and you almost, especially the teams that win, that sweep those series, you almost forget that they're still in the playoffs because they haven't played for a week.
Waiting around, trying to stay excited and in shape.
Yeah, but then you flip and you look at maybe like a San Antonio-Denver series, which I think will go seven games, and it's going to be very competitive and athletic, and suddenly these teams are wasting all this energy in the first round, and if San Antonio is going to make that run, it is interesting to look at maybe a team a couple years ago that breezed through their first round series to head all the way towards the conference finals, whereas I'm thinking San Antonio is going to be wasting a lot of energy just to get by Denver.
At the beginning of these playoffs, of course, 16 teams theoretically have a shot. Who do you like once the smoke clears and two teams face each other for the championship?
Yeah, I think Detroit out of the East. They've got the coaching, and they've got last year to build off. Versus Phoenix, let's have some fun. Let's put these run-and-gun Phoenix Suns in the finals, and it'll be a good battle of Detroit, a defensive team, and Phoenix, a team that likes to run with the Bulls. So, yeah, let's do that.
Benjamin Hochman writes about the NBA for the New Orleans Times-Picayune. He joined me from the Big Easy, whose 18 and 64 Hornets have scattered to golf courses all over the country by now. Thank you, Benjamin.
Thanks for having me.
The New Jersey Nets were the very last NBA team to qualify for the postseason. Only a game's Gabe O'Connor was present for the occasion, and he has this report.
There he is.
Late Wednesday night at Boston's Fleet Center, Nets owner Bruce Ratner was outside his team's locker room celebrating with fans and friends. With the victory over the Boston Celtics on the final day of the season, his team had just clinched the eighth and final spot in the Eastern Conference playoffs. This almost didn't happen. In an off-season cost-cutting move, all-star forward Kenyon Martin was traded to Denver for draft picks. The team started off the regular season with a 2-11 record. Then, in January, all-star guard Richard Jefferson went down for the regular season with a wrist injury. By this point, guard Jason Kidd was still recovering from off-season knee surgery and allegedly wanted out of New Jersey. Even a mid-season trade for all-star Vince Carter couldn't stop the Nets' tumble into the abyss. By January, the Nets were 12-24 and seemed done for the season. New York Times reporter Jason Dimos certainly thought so.
Not at all. It didn't. The only person who actually kept talking about the playoffs was Richard Jefferson, who wasn't even playing. He, at one point, had told me that he'd never played on a losing team in his life, and this was right around the time when they were 12 games below 500, and he said, I'm not going to be on one this year either. And lo and behold, the Nets were 42-40. But I think if you would have said playoffs in the locker room at that time, people would have laughed.
But the Nets turned it around. Kidd and Carter began to click and became one of the NBA's most formidable duos. Center Nenad Krstić provided some much-needed inside scoring, and suddenly the Nets were one of the hottest teams in the Eastern Conference as they closed out the season winning 15 of their last 19 games. Back at the Fleet Center, Coach Lawrence Frank reveled in his team's clinching win.
You know, I don't want to play it like, you know, we're the little train that could, but not a whole lot of people gave our guys a whole lot of chances. And when you start from the off season in June and all the things that have happened throughout the course of the year, for our guys to be able to be playing in the postseason just speaks volumes about their character.
Nets forward Brian Scalabrine thinks the C word shouldn't have been an issue, and their comeback shouldn't have been a surprise.
Whatever you guys think about our character all season long, I thought we've always had it, and the reason why we do, well, I guess not all season long, but Vince and Jason pretty much set the tone, and everybody else just follows, and when those guys are going, we're a tough team to beat from there.
Apparently not too tough for the Miami Heat, the East number one seed and the Nets' first-round opponent. The Heat, led by Behemoth center Shaquille O'Neal, won all three of its games against the Nets this season, including a 90-65 shellacking back in March. However, Carter says that Nets team no longer exists.
I think just everything is different in our team. You know, ever since that game, I think we were just a totally different team. You know, the look of our team, the swagger of our team, the confidence of our team after that game has just been totally different.
So things may be different, but this is still the Heat. The combination of O'Neal on the inside and budding superstar Dwayne Wade on the outside has dominated the East all season long. And Carter knows that no matter how much things have improved for the Nets, this is still going to be an incredible test.
The level that we've played these past 10, 12 games, it's going to have to be that every night, if not better than that. Some people may say, oh, they can't play any better than that. That might be true, but if we're going to even have a chance, that's going to be needed from each player, not just, you know, one or two guys, all 12, 15 guys.
Fortunately for the Nets, Richard Jefferson will return from the disabled list for the start of the playoffs, making New Jersey as talented as any 8 seed has ever been. Another boon for the Nets is O'Neal's injured thigh that could limit his playing time. Game 1 tips off tomorrow in Miami. For Only a Game, I'm Gabe O'Connor in Boston.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. If siblings Mark, Diana, and Stephen Lopez all still lived in the same house, Shea Lopez would need additional shelves for the trophies the three Taekwondo experts won last weekend. On Friday, Stephen, 26, won the welterweight title for the third consecutive year. Then on Sunday, Diana, 21, finished conquering everybody in the women's featherweight division, and brother Mark achieved the same result among featherweights of the male persuasion. The three gold medals added up to the best world championship performance for a U.S. team, as well as a most exceptional performance by fighting relatives. Now we just have to hope that the family that kicks together sticks together. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, we'll take it to the paint with some wheelchair-bound hoopsters on Arizona's Navajo Reservation. But first, as Lance Armstrong and more than 150 other international cyclists wind their way around the Peach State for the Tour de Georgia, fans could be forgiven for scanning the pack for the next great American cyclist. The sport will be losing its top two American stars. On Monday, Lance Armstrong announced that he would retire from the sport after the July Tour de France, on the same day his heir apparent, Tyler Hamilton, was suspended from competition for 2 years for blood doping. Richard Fries is the editor-in-chief of The Ride magazine, and he joins me now in the studio. Richard, welcome back to Only a Game.
Oh, it's good to be here. I wish I wasn't here under these circumstances.
I wish so, too, but I'm going to ask you, which was more of a surprise for you, Lance's announcement that he would retire or the decision to suspend Tyler Hamilton?
Or that they both came on the same day, because rarely do you see cycling on ESPN twice on the same day. I would say the Tyler thing sort of shocked me a little bit. It was looking very hopeful due to the length of the time it was taking them to really come to a decision, and also the severity of the penalty. In addition to the 2 years of any competition, they've banned him from the Pro Tour for 4 years.
As you say, Tyler Hamilton had been waiting for a ruling since testimony ended in his case back on March the 2nd. A three-person arbitration panel appointed by the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency ruled that Hamilton's positive tests were a result of blood transfusions. But the decision was not unanimous. On what issues did the panelists disagree?
Yeah, if you like the Da Vinci Code, you're going to just go on Tyler's website because it's a little bit of cloak and dagger in there. It's very interesting. The dissenting opinion filed by Chris Campbell was pretty impressive in how they can sort of have different testing analyses used. It's kind of a fascinating case in how it's being interpreted. There's still a little bit to go because this is going to go to the Court of Sports Arbitration.
Well, that was going to be my next question. Hamilton next appeals his case to the Court of Arbitration for Sport in Switzerland. Is there any reason to expect a different result?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the Court of Sports Arbitration is where you sort of see the melding of civil law and sports law come into play and the rights of an individual being a little bit more sacrosanct than they are. You sort of sign your life away when you're going into Olympic sports with WADA and USADA, and they've really been granted considerable amounts of power. And the criteria that they use for deeming that you're guilty is pretty loose still to some degree. I can guarantee you that the baseball union would never accept the USADA stipulations.
Tyler's appeal, it seems to me, has to be based on either the fact that the test was inaccurate, or if the test was accurate, there's some other explanation for his appearing to have blood other than his own blood circulating in his system. What is his contention?
He's not saying I had a transfusion. He's not saying I'm a twin. He's not saying all these other things that could have excused it. What Tyler Hamilton is saying is there's some real questions on the custody of the sample, and it doesn't make sense. Blood doping is not about performance enhancing on the day of. Blood doping is about giving you the ability to really train at a super high level and recover. And when they are saying the window of your transfusions would have been, it makes no sense as to when it would have worked for Tyler. His contention is also what is the speed limit here? Basically, to use that analogy, you've got a guy in Athens who looks at the test and says, no, I don't see a population of red blood cells. That is enough to really ring the alarm bells. And then later they looked at it and they sort of had a little tighter discretion as to what they would accept or not accept. So one of the contentions is you can't change it based on who is reading the test. The test has to be the same. It has to be the same radar gun used all the time. And then there's just the validity of a test being put into place, rushing it into place and putting that much on the line.
When the test results for Tyler Hamilton were first announced, many people said that a suspension would end his career, essentially. Does that still seem to be the case?
It's a pretty good grim reaper of a career at this level. Very few people have been competitive at the Tour de France beyond the age of 32. Joop Zoetemelk won it at the age of 38. And then you look at the rising stars coming up in the sport, and it just gets harder and harder. You really get a very narrow window of experience and age and build up to be able to be competitive at this. So it remains to be seen if Tyler can come back. He could probably race out a few years in the domestic scene, which is a growing and a very good scene in America, and probably draw some good wages for doing so. What's really interesting is that your reputation is everything. You know, look at the endorsements he was getting. Look at how much popularity he had, a foundation going. Even if he was to be reinstated today, he's been punished pretty severely on a fiscal term.
Assuming that he avoids disaster in France this July, Lance Armstrong will be leaving his sport while he's at the top. And I can't help wondering if this retirement is going to stick or if we're going to see more of him like we did Michael Jordan and Magic Johnson and Ozzy Osbourne and everybody else who never really retires.
It's actually interesting. Lance Armstrong showed up at a little tiny race in Ojai, California, a little suburb of Los Angeles, about a 40-minute drive away. Just showed up, walked up, registered. Friend actually registered for him, pinned his own number on, and got a very good 15th place, I believe. And he's actually kind of showed up at a few little races here and there. It's been kind of like the Rolling Stones playing in a little club now and again. We would love it if he jumped into a mountain bike race or took on our beloved cyclocross here and there, and he may or may not do that. But I think when you retire from the sport at the pro tour level, it's a big step down.
That brings up, of course, the question of how good a retiree Lance Armstrong will be, because, of course, some professional athletes handle retirement much better than others.
Well, we're in the cycling world, we're a little befuddled by this because we've never had a star this big. We're just not used to celebrity status like this. Normally, you go and you work in the bike industry,
right,
or you know, and
get a real job.
And he's got options involving everything from politics to he's going to be probably working with the Discovery Channel, developing himself for some television work. You know, he can really write his own ticket just about anywhere he can want to go. It's going to be there for him.
Meanwhile, Armstrong's performance thus far in the Tour de Georgia has some wondering if he has any chance at a seventh straight Tour de France win, others suggesting that he's holding back, that this is a psych. What do you think? Is Lance slowing down, or is he just setting everybody up?
You read so much into these spring results, but what you really are looking at is he's riding with the best riders in the world in Georgia. He's holding his own. He actually made some pretty good efforts to win a bunch sprint the other day, which is really working way over the red zone. And a lot of times it's a lot like making a three-point shot. You know, it just doesn't always fall the way you need it to. The Tour de France is a different thing. He's right on track. Some people say he's a little heavy. I just don't buy it. I think his times are good, his focus is good, and I think that he'll be able to muster one good effort. The big question is the rising competition in Europe right now.
Well, let's assume for the sake of argument that Tyler Hamilton is in fact suspended for some considerable length of time and that Lance Armstrong makes good on his threat to retire. What then? Is American cycling dead? Who do we look to next?
Somebody came into my office today and called Monday Black Monday for cycling, and I really beg to differ. The biggest thing about Lance Armstrong is not what he did for the sport as we know it. It was what it did for guys like you. The guys in the media had something to really hang their coat on. They really had something to follow. They had it in their date books. We got to watch Lance in the Tour. And I think it's going to be a little bit like me as a little kid. Joe Namath made the NFL for me. And for years afterwards, I was looking for that other story for Joe Namath. So you've got this wonderful sport, probably three times as many participants as golf in America, and they're into it. I don't think they're going away. Additionally, a lot of good Americans right now.
Richard Fries is the editor-in-chief of The Ride magazine. Richard, thank you very much for speaking with
me. Always great to be here.
According to the National Council on Disability, Native Americans are the most likely ethnic group in the country to have physical disabilities. And on remote reservations like the Navajo, which spreads across parts of Arizona, Utah, and New Mexico, the disabled deal with challenges not faced in other parts of the country. From Arizona Public Radio, Daniel Crocker reports on efforts to improve lives on the country's largest Indian reservation through basketball.
Inside the cavernous gym at Monument Valley High School, 10 Navajo tribal members zip around the court on specially designed athletic wheelchairs. After warming up, they gather in front of Dr. Ellen Rothman.
I'm really excited that this is our first real official practice for our Mustangs wheelchair basketball team, and I'm thankful to you guys for being here today.
Rothman is a pediatrician at the Indian Health Service Clinic in the reservation town of Kayenta, Arizona, just south of the Utah border. She helped secure a grant of nearly $20,000 from the Christopher Reeve Foundation to buy the wheelchairs. The team is preparing for a halftime demonstration tonight at the able-bodied high school boys varsity game. Rothman tries to ease the players' fears about performing in front of more than 2,000 fans.
I think even just getting out there, taking a lap around, and getting our names announced will help the community be more cognizant of disability issues and think more about us when they're planning activities, because at this point, there's really nothing out there for us.
By nothing, Rothman means no social outlets. There's also no public transportation, few paved roads, and even fewer sidewalks. And many buildings on the reservation are not handicapped accessible. As a result, most disabled people on the reservation lead lives of isolation. Darlene Singer, who took part in the morning's practice, lives 3 miles from the nearest paved road, more than 20 miles from Kayenta. This is high desert country. The quiet hangs thick in the cold air. But inside, a wood stove keeps it snug and warm. Singer sits in her wheelchair at the kitchen table after a lunch of spaghetti and fry bread. 18 years ago, a car accident left her a paraplegic. Singer moved back home. She likes living here with her mom, but admits things could be better.
What I really need out here is a phone line. That's about 2 miles from here, the main phone line. And I applied for it, but the phone company told me I have to pay it out of my own pocket.
That would have cost more than $10,000. Singer does have a cell phone, but she doesn't get reception at her house. 2 years ago, she was home alone shortly after bladder surgery.
And my incision, it reopened, and I didn't know what was going on. It was just bleeding, draining, so I just laid back down.
Luckily, her uncle dropped by and drove to a relative's house to call an ambulance. Singer's story is frightening, but the hardships she faces are not uncommon on remote reservations. Howard Kinlachini is the paraplegic player coach of the Mustangs wheelchair basketball team. He lives in a home with no utilities.
God, man, it just takes everything out of you, you know? There's no running water, electricity, then have to travel 35 miles out of town to get some clean water and coal and whatnot to be warm with.
Kinlachini says when he was first injured 13 years ago, he wouldn't leave the house for days. Now he has a newfound self-esteem and says he's excited about playing basketball again at the same high school he attended 20 years ago. At halftime, Kinlachini leads the team onto the court. They line up on both sides of the lane and pass the ball back and forth in a weave. They haven't had a chance to compete yet, but want to show the crowd what wheelchair basketball is all about. Eventually, one of the players hoists up a shot. After about 5 minutes of the demonstration, Gleave Isaac sits in his chair, still buzzing with excitement.
With all the cheering, with all the support from the audience, the good turnout, all of my nerves and my butterfly just went away. It was fantastic. It was fantastic. I love it. I'm sure they're already looking forward to seeing us again out there someday in court.
And off the court as well. Dr. Rothman has raised money to install a wheelchair lift into the high school's pool. She's also organized movie nights and monthly support group meetings. Her goal is to make the Navajo Nation more accepting and more aware of people with disabilities. For Only a Game, I'm Daniel Crocker on the Navajo Reservation.
For more on this week's stories, pictures from stories past and present, commentaries galore, and the opportunity to write email to us, check out our website, onlyagame.org. You're listening to Only a Game. Part of my conversation with Charlie Pierce last week dealt with a proposal by some Canadians to award the Stanley Cup this spring, despite the fact that the National Hockey League failed to provide a season. Maybe that's not such a bad idea, wrote Michael D. Trout, who hears Only a Game on WAMC in Albany, New York. Why not award the cup to the champion of the next best league, the American Hockey League? I rather like the idea of the cup going to Rochester, Manchester, or Binghamton, or maybe to St. John's, Hamilton, or the Manitoba Moose. Don Millis, who identifies himself as abiding in, quote, coastal Carolina, end quote, emailed to say, most enjoyable show, particularly the Polish priest's walleye. That was a reference to Father Mariusz, who displayed the impressive fish that he'd caught in order to raise money for tsunami victims in India. But, Mr. Millis continued, your expert on record bass talked about taxidermists making a mold for a trophy fish. Doesn't he know that they mostly just pull a plastic fish off the shelf with the same measurements as your fish and mount it on a plaque? The aforementioned expert on record bass is Monty Burke, author of Sowbelly, The Obsessive Quest for the World Record Largemouth Bass. My conversation with Mr. Burke last week provoked this response on the listener line.
Hi, my name is John Tyson. I listen to Only a Game on WBUR. Longtime fan of Only a Game and of Bill Littlefield. But just disturbed about the fishing segment today. The idea of watching a beautiful animal gasping for breath and dying, it's, somehow it just to me does not seem like a sport. These are ways in which we rationalize our slaughtering our fellow species. So keep up the good work, but please, I would really appreciate a more compassionate approach.
Among the other listeners emailing this week to suggest how only a game could be improved was Bob Hoyer, who hears the show on WMRA in Harrisonburg, Virginia. Mr. Hoyer wrote, "Invite listeners to participate in a weekly contest to be chosen to read the scores. How difficult could that be? Then you would say, yesterday's NBA scores are reported by Mildred Winkler, who usually spends her time selling real estate." How difficult could that be? You can send your suggestions to Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu, but it's easier to reach us through the website, onlyagame.org. You can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, by dairy farm families from Massachusetts and throughout New England who own Cabot Creamery, five generations making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, cabotcheese.com, and by Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting, available at the Implant Dentistry Center at bicon.com, bicon.com.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Mike Vecht's stunning contention that fun is good. But first, joining me for Look the Week's News is our own Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
The NBA playoffs begin this afternoon. Will you be watching, or do you only begin to pay attention after the first round has eliminated some of the pretenders?
Well, I'll be watching, with a little bit of local interest since the Boston Celtics won their division and then were rewarded by playing the not inconsiderable Indiana Pacers, which is quite a stumbling block in the first round. And I'm a little bit interested in seeing how Miami reacts to not having, really played at full strength for a while. Shaquille tells us he's been getting a lot of rest.
That's
no
what he says.
No kidding, by the way.
And I would assume that's bad news for opponents if it's true.
It's bad news for the rest of the Eastern Conference because there is nobody in the Eastern Conference who can guard him.
Among the teams that did not make the playoffs are the Cleveland Cavaliers. And after Wednesday night's game, LeBron James must be wondering what he has to do to haul Cleveland up the next step.
The Cleveland Cavaliers, who have already in their history been afflicted with Ted Stepien, appear to be afflicted with another meddling owner who fired the coach in the middle of the year. And then when the team didn't respond to this particular piece of brainiac, fired Jim Paxton, the general manager. By the end of the year, LeBron James was playing 46 and a half minutes a game. He clearly wore down the team, which I saw in February as a very strong playoff contention, sort of got left by the wayside.
It is NFL draft weekend. Since we have a lot of topics to cover in a limited amount of time, I will give you 1 minute to deliver the Charlie Pierce mock draft for all seven rounds. Ready, go!
Actually, I have in my hand here a chat from ESPN.com from a few days back, and the moderator says, the first pick will be coming up, and we'll start with a question from, and it's, you can read it right here on the radio, Bill in Boston. Now, do you have some sort of secret draftnik other personality that I'm not aware of? Are you taking Wonderlic tests in your basement, not telling your wife and children?
Drat, they're on to me.
I don't know. The big thing in the draft seems to be which one of the quarterbacks, either the quarterback from California or the quarterback from Utah, is going to get the person that drafts them fired the fastest.
It was announced this week, Charlie, that the 2005 NFL season will be the last for Monday Night Football on ABC, which has broadcast the program for 35 years, believe it or not. What will you subsequently do with your Monday night?
Every time I turn on Monday Night Football for at least the last 26 years, it's 10-3 in the middle of the third quarter. No matter what time of the evening I turn it on, it's 10-3 in the middle of the third quarter. So I guess if I'm going to check in as to what point in the game it's 10-3 in the middle of the third quarter, I'm going to ESPN now.
Former coach Clarence Big House Gaines, who led Winston-Salem State basketball to 828 wins over 47 seasons, died this week, Charlie. Mr. Gaines was 81 years old. Winston-Salem plays at the Division II level. Were you acquainted with the work of Mr. Gaines?
Well, everyone is acquainted with every coach by the players he produces. His most famous was obviously Earl Monroe, who played for the Knicks. I did see Coach Gaines at the Final Four. He seemed to be okay. We talked for a brief bit, but he is the last of that generation that began in the what were then called the traditionally black colleges.
Major League Baseball decided this week that there was no need to punish New York Yankees outfielder Gary Sheffield for the misadventure in Fenway Park last week involving Sheffield, a fan, some cups of beer, one intrepid security guard, and a ball that was still in play. Were you surprised at MLB's decision?
No, I was surprised that Sheffield got nothing. I thought he might get a token $1,500 slap on the pinky for doing what he did, because he really did. He did go into the stands prior to not going into the stands.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't hurl himself into the stands. But I guess that baseball has contented itself with the fact that this is really a problem with the fans. And if you've noticed, recently at games in Fenway, when the ball goes down either the left or right field lines, you see people recoiling back from the railing as though a snake has come down to bite them.
This week, International Olympic Committee President Jacques Rogge warned all the cities bidding to host the 2012 Olympics to, quote, obey ethics rules and stay out of a bidding war. Isn't the whole idea of a bidding process to create a bidding war, or at least a bidding competition of some sort? What's this all about?
I think you've made the distinction. They want a nice, polite bidding competition. They want everything above board and above, nothing going on under the table. Of course, the Olympic table is approximately as high as K2, and virtually everything can go underneath it. What you're dealing with here is something that you and I have long on this show called the Louis Reyno approach to running your sport, which is basically a couple years down the line when we find out that the bidding competition has turned into a bidding war, it is very important to be shocked to learn that.
Among the sports-related items available at auction these days is a 5-pound box of mail sent to former Tampa Bay Buccaneer Warren Sapp. The letters are especially valuable because Mr. Sapp never opened them, let alone answered them. Why would anybody want 5 pounds of somebody else's mail?
I have absolutely no idea, but PSC Collectibles, which is apparently filed for bankruptcy, is shocked to learn that, has called it the bittersweet find because you feel bad for the fans who took the time to write Mr. Sapp and got nothing in return. Who exactly is the Sapp in this transaction?
It's just an endless list. My favorite score of the week is a rugby result. Penalta RFC 170. Cardiff Canton RFC 0. I particularly like the Canton spokesman's explanation.
Yeah, the Canton spokesman said it's just one of those things, but I like the Dave Stevens, the Penalta committee member, said 170 mil has got to be one-sided to a certain extent, but Canton didn't roll over and die. They threatened to score several times and played with spirit right to the whistle. I certainly hope the beer was cold.
And finally, Charlie, let us celebrate Australian surfer Simon Letch, who last Saturday overcame a sharp challenge to his attempt to return to dry land.
He was something tried to eat him, Bill. Mm-hmm.
A great large something.
A very great large shark went after him, and he went back to the beach a half an hour after surviving the shark attack, despite the fact that the beach was closed.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me each week at this time for Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you, Bill.
That Mike Vick chose to follow in his father's footsteps might seem a decision doomed from the start to explode in the face of Vick the Younger. As the serial proprietor of several baseball teams between 1946 and 1980, Bill Vick employed a midget to pinch hit, brought Satchel Paige to the major leagues, and set the all-time unbreakable career record for amount of fun had by an owner. How would the son outdo the father in the same line of work? How would he even begin to compare? Mike Vick joins me now from ARP Studios in Charleston, South Carolina, to discuss that challenge and talk about his new book, Fun is Good, How to Create Joy and Passion in Your Workplace and Career. Mike, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you so much, Bill. It's a pleasure.
You and your father shared a taste for promotions that most baseball people would probably associate with the minor leagues rather than the major leagues. Why don't we get Disco Demolition Night out of the way right at the top here?
I think that in that approach, we are very similar. I don't know that there are such a thing as Major League Baseball fans and Minor League Baseball fans. I think there are people and things that make them laugh. And in the case of Disco Demolition, I got out of school, joined a rock and roll band, played a couple, 3 years on the road, loathed disco. And we were, in 1979, experiencing some small difficulties drawing on occasion, especially a Thursday night, Twi night doubleheader against Detroit, which was not really a duel of the Titans. Mm-hmm. So we invited everybody in the greater Chicagoland area to bring a disco record between games of the doubleheader. We would put them in a dumpster with a stick of dynamite and blow them up. 60,000 people were inside. 40,000 people were outside. It was the largest traffic jam in the history of Chicago. At 8:35, I'm throwing my back out, congratulating myself. I mean, we've more than sold out. I'm standing on the field watching the pyrotechnics as the records go 250 feet in the air. And then out of the corner of my eye down the right field foul pole, I see a fan shimmying. And I know that life, as I knew it moments before, was going to change. Soon there were 10,000 kids on the field. We ended up forfeiting the second game of the doubleheader because of a great performance by Sparky Anderson in his inaugural season as manager of the Tigers.
Meaning this field is unplayable. We've got to have this game forfeited.
They should rename the Tonys the Sparkies for the performance. I mean, he was brilliant. And right before my eyes, my career passed in front. I went from being, the guy who drew 100,000 people to 35th and Shields to the godfather of Disco Demolition, the fourth forfeiture in the history of baseball. And it was, oddly enough, Bill, it was my father who was the one person who really understood. While the newspapers were, slamming, and I didn't know what a slow news day was back in those days. I sure do now. 4 pages in the Tribune, 3 in the Sun-Times. Dad said every once in a while, there's a promotion that works too well. Mm-hmm. I guess that was when I made a decision that was going to be hard to employ me for the next 20 years, at least at the major league level.
I guess we could file my next question under the heading of last laughs, because it is a fact that though you couldn't get back into baseball for quite some time, a decade or so, you are now the most successful owner of minor league teams that I know anything about. How'd that happen?
In 1989, I was in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, running an advertising agency, and a gentleman by the name of Marv Goldklang, now my partner, then a limited partner of the Yankees in every sense of the word, called and said, I think there ought to be a VEC in baseball. And I said to him, I bet you think I haven't heard that before. And I hung up, and he called back and he said, well, you're as rude as I heard. Are you any good? And I said, well, I don't know. I haven't done anything for 10 years. And he said, well, I ran into Roland Hemond, who was then general manager of the Orioles, and I told him that we had just purchased the Miami Miracle, and Roland said in one of the great lines of all time, if you're dumb enough to buy the Miami Miracle, you're dumb enough to hire Vec. So Bill Murray, Jimmy Buffett, and Marv Goldklang and Van Schley hired me to run the Miami Miracle starting in 1990, and over the last 15 years, we've bought and sold a bunch of ball clubs and had more fun than any five guys should be entitled to for a lifetime.
What's the minor league promotion of which you are most proud?
I have to tell you, I love MimoVision. The premise of it is so ridiculous. I went and hired five mimes and got them to recreate close plays. And sure enough, in the fourth inning, there was a close play, bam, bam, at first base. The mimes jumped up on top of the dugout, recreated the play, and 6,329 fans in St. Paul sat there in utter stupefaction. They couldn't believe anything was that dumb.
It's a good thing they didn't have anything to throw.
Well, actually, in ballparks, you provide them with what we call red and yellows. A kid in the front row had a hot dog fully dressed, took a look at one of those mimes, and voted. Before I knew it, we had the largest food fight going in the history. In the seventh inning, the mimes are hunkered down. In the eighth inning, they were saying things, Bill, that weren't very mime-like.
Well, tell me about a minor league promotion that you wish you'd never thought of.
Voodoo Night on Friday the 13th here in Charleston. I thought I could hide behind the very literate idea The book Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil was very popular. So I thought we would hand out voodoo dolls, little pins, invite everybody in on Friday the 13th, and it would be a very mystical, mysterious night. I'm Catholic. The fact that it was Good Friday didn't frighten me on the front end. On the back end, it should have terrified me. After the calls that I got, ranging from the devil as residing at the ball yard to 666, it lasted, I think, 72 hours, and Bill Murray was vacationing down here. He said, call a press conference, tell them you're sorry, tell them you're stupid, and tell them you'll never do it again. And I really recoiled at that. I was going to hold my ground, and the next day we called a press conference. I told him I was stupid, told him I was sorry, and it might happen again. I don't recommend doing anything on Good Friday.
The subtitle of your book suggests that readers can learn to, quote, create joy and passion in their own workplaces. And it's a fine notion, but I can't quite see how sack races or sumo wrestling in inflatable suits, let alone vasectomy night, and we haven't even talked about that, I can't really see it working in most accounting firms or brokerage offices. How does one apply your lessons to something other than an entertainment business?
People mistakenly believe that it only works in service businesses, and I think accounting firms are a great example of things. First of all, the decorations around a place of business, you know, cubicles that are gray and the same size, and they kill you with the fact of their sameness, and I think they should be decorated. I think there should be music piped in. I think that you should have relaxed days at work, not Friday where you can wear anything, but any day that people can feel comfortable. I think there should be meetings once a week about what's happening in the company as a whole, where you're going. No closed-door meetings that are exclusive, but meetings that are inclusive. And most importantly, I think that people have to take the time themselves to speak to one another. I think we've become so isolated in our technology that we are so facile and capable at emailing someone but not stopping someone in a hall and saying, how are your kids? You know, how was your vacation? And having real conversation. We're busy, we think, and I think it's egocentric. We're so busy. We're all so busy. But what is it we're doing? I don't think that if we examined our lives that we'd see our productivity is so much higher. I think we're going through motions.
Mike Vec, minor league baseball executive par excellence, is the author of Fun is Good, How to Create Joy and Passion in Your Workplace and Career, published by Rodale. Mike joined me from ARP Studio in Charleston, South Carolina. Mike, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you so much.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from George Hicks and Tim Scope. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to check out some wonderful photos of sumo wrestlers in advance of next month's Grand National Sumo Tournament, learn more about Mike Vec's Fun is Good, browse Only a Game show archive, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from NBA scribe Benjamin Hockman. I asked if he expected fans of the 18-64 New Orleans Hornets to show more interest in the NBA playoffs than they had in their team during the regular season.
We've got the Jazz Festival. It's this weekend, and people are coming to town to drink beer and listen to music and not think about sports. I'm going to go with no.
Memo to Commissioner Stern. The Bon Temps will roulette right along in the Big Easy, with or without an NBA team. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, from NPR member stations, from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from Vision to Innovative Impact, 75 years of philanthropy, on the web at wkkf.org, and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.